You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is June Jordan, and it's on the occasion of two new books. One of them is from High Risk Press, which is a division of Serpent's Tail, called Haruka Loves Poems, and the other is from Vintage. It's the paperback edition of her book of essays, Technical Difficulties. And I guess, oddly, I wanted to begin by talking about an essay of yours that thrilled me that wasn't from either of these books, but it's the essay on Phyllis Wheatley. And she was the first black American poet, and you make a case for her being one of the very first American poets. I wondered whether you could speak about people's poetry.
Well, in the case of Phyllis Wheatley, it's a heartbreaking, complicated situation to try and fathom, because, of course, she was brought here as a 7-year-old little girl from Africa to the slave block here on auction. And, you know, her people, for example, the people of that poet, would have been her mother and father, from whom she'd been stolen away. And then she came here, and she was adopted by a white family. And comparatively speaking, she was fortunate, because they recognized very quickly that she was, in fact, a stone genius, and they, taught her to read and write and so on in this language, which was other than her own native language, clearly. And so she, I do think she was the first American poet, because I don't think you can find anybody before Phyllis Wheatley. I may be mistaken, but I don't think so, who was writing about distinctly American subjects, you know, and trying to endow them with kind of majesty of importance and so on that, for example, English poets previously might have attributed to somebody ascending to the throne or something like that, you know, one of the Henrys or what have you. But at the same time, she was, of course, an African American, truly, and you can find in her early verse some really moving and anguished references to having been to the loss of her family and of her original people, you know, whom she could never hope to find or join again.
Well, what I found interesting about the essay was that you suggested that given the amount of unnecessary poetic tradition imposed upon her, the heroic couplets, the Christianity implicit in her training, it's all, you know, Christian training, that this poetry is stranger than poetry would be. It's almost, you suggest, like Borges says about Pierre Menard writing Quixote, that it was difficult enough for Cervantes, but imagine someone sitting down to write Quixote who doesn't come from that background. Mm-hmm. So here you have a poetry of, what would you call it, enforcement and imposition, out of which this anguish nevertheless emerges as if through the cracks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I tried to, in that essay, I tried to suggest that task, her task, her original task, is the task of black poets today, I mean, continues through today, is to take what, it's something really imposed upon us, and which by definition is not supposed to define us in a positive way at all, and nonetheless work with it to say something from our hearts and having to do with our, you know, heartfelt objectives.
Now, many of the essays in Technical Difficulties are very painful to read. For me, none more so than the essay on modern education called Finding the Haystack and the Needle. And you talk about a reading you gave at LACC in which you apologized to the students that you yourself do not have poems of the Asian experience or poems that you've written in Spanish. Now, I want, should you, or even can you, can a poet write from an experience that's not his or her own?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, I always tell my students, I always tell myself as well, that poetry's about telling the truth. And so if you're going to fake it, obviously you're at odds with the requirements of the art of poetry. But on the other hand, we live in a really heterogeneous world. And I don't live in an entirely African-American world or a black and white world. You know, I live in a world of many languages and people of many different ethnicities and racial backgrounds, including mixtures of among those differences. So given the fact that this is where I live, to attempt to work with that complexity, for example, taking on a language's additional to English, black English, I think is an honest undertaking. And as long as it's clear, I'm not pretending to be a Chicana poet. That's not, you know, for example, or a Vietnamese-American poet. No, 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 no. But rather that I am who I am, endeavoring to work with all the kinds of language materials around me that I'm hearing or that people I come to know and care about find important to use.
As I was reading the essays, I found myself thinking, by what means does one attain the authority or freedom to speak for anyone outside oneself?
I don't know. I don't know if that's what's happening. That's what I was trying to say earlier. I don't know if it's about speaking for anyone outside oneself, but rather I think what I'm trying to do is to stay in touch with the expansion of my identity, of my personal identity. You know, it's both an accidental and a deliberate expansion that I find ongoing. So that I'm not then attempting to impersonate someone other than myself, but rather to express and to reflect upon ways in which my own identity has become augmented as a result of my contact with other kinds of people, with other kinds of concerns and languages and histories than my own. You know,
but it's an interesting thing. For instance, I mean, I find this subject fascinating. Recently, I was moved to go and check Longfellow's Hiawatha because I wanted to see what that white American had made of the Indian traditions that he was really trying to be respectful to. When I went back to the book, you know, this enormous, if there is a pantheism, a respect for multiple gods, in that book, Longfellow seems to be very willing to give himself over to a cosmos, a world vision of the Indian. He's not always right, but he is always generous. And yet we would step away and say, this is an act of imperialism. You know, where are the Indian poets whose voices we should be hearing other than Longfellow's? Doesn't it seem that there's always a...
Well, I don't think I worry about that so much. I think what I worry about much more is anybody, including myself, coming to the conclusion that he or she is this and not that, and comfortably fixing yourself in that kind of a place, you know, which is opposite to what it means to be a living organism, which is to change, you know, constantly. And and then having decided that you are this and not that, to be fearful of that which is not you, and closed to that which is not you. In other words, to reject and, if possible, to destroy the other, someone who is different from yourself, or something that you think is outside yourself, your purview, your people, your understanding, your responsibility, however you want to define it. That I find more worrisome. I mean, I have a program I'm trying to establish right now at UC Berkeley called Poetry for the People. And one of the things I do there is I try to put together as Catholic a syllabus as possible, you know, white poetry, black poetry, Native American, Asian American, gay and lesbian, women's poetry. And every time I ask the students, after we present on this or that kind of poetry, I want, for next week, I want you to write a Native American poetry, a poem. And they go, but I'm not Native American. I said, no, but if you study the poems that we have given you here, try to come up with, and you listen to whatever the guy or woman had to say when it came in, talking about what's specific to the worldview of, you know, of Native American, so you should be able to come up with some kind of a reasonable facsimile of a Native American. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And but the spirit of the undertaking is deeply respectful. It's that of a student, you know. It's not that of a thief.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that of a student, of someone's trying to say, well, and it's just like I know from a long time ago when I was an undergraduate, the mere fact of copying out in my hand, I'm literally in my hand, a poem written by Tennyson, let's say, for example, made such a difference to my possible understanding of what he was about, even, you know, and the craft that was implied by a line of his work. And that was a kind of appropriation, if you will. Yeah, I wasn't changing it, but I was taking it from the printed page into my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that physical transference brought me much closer to him as a poet than any other thing I could think of, you know. And I think we're in a situation, in my opinion, I think we're in a situation, all of us, I mean, in a situation where we just have to try to do a lot of stuff that seems inherently awkward and clumsy, and does body forth the risk of making terrible mistakes, you know. And it's way more than having not a good accent. You know, it's way more awful than that sometimes. But what's the alternative? Seems to me, I think the alternative is, to me, is really harrowing and unacceptable.
I'm talking to June Jordan, the author of the book of essays recently republished by Vintage, Technical Difficulties. She's the author as well of a new book of poems from High Risk Books, which is a division of Serpent's Tale. Could you say something about High Risk? Because it is a new series, and I wondered where it comes from.
My understanding is that it's really the brainchild of Ira Silverberg and Amy Scholder. And both of them are in their 20s, and one of them is Ira's based on the East Coast, and Amy's in San Francisco. And they have this idea of trying to put out books that they think are, in some way or another, taking risks and representing people and or issues that a lot of other presses would probably shy away from. And I think they're in the process, really, of determining what they mean altogether by high risk. I don't think they're settled yet on that. I'm not sure, but I hope not.
How the book is both a new poem sequence, Haruko, and a collection of poems from other books, love poems.
Love poems, yeah.
How did you decide to wed these two pieces together?
Well, for many years, people have said to me they really wish I would come out with a book of my love poems, because they felt people who know me principally as a political activist, writer, and so on, and poet, didn't realize I've been steadily writing all these love poems, and they thought it would be really interesting to have this other aspect come to people's awareness. And then Adrienne Rich just became very... very serious in her insistence, as she knows how to do, that I try to do that, you know. And in fact, she helped organize this book, as I acknowledge happily, the order of the poems and all that, and which poems will go in, to try to put together a collection of my love poems, so people would know who I am in those ways, as a poet, a love poet. And really, the model for me was Pablo Neruda, and I think it's the first. I think it's the first time that an African American poet, a major African American poet, has come out with a book of love poems, period. So I see it as a political act.
Well, as I was reading Haruko, which seemed an astonishing sequence to me because it is a sequence that is by and large about rejection. And I, you know, what gets said around my world a lot is that people don't know how to love, but I think that that may not be true. I think that people really don't know how to integrate rejection. Mm-hmm. That rejection is the enormous fear. It's the blockade against love. It's not so much that we can't love. It's more that we can't stand the threat of rejection. These poems seem to be written, you know, out of an intense experience of misery and pain. And I wondered if you would explain the poem's genesis.
Yeah, that's true. There's intense misery and pain, but that's the that's one side of it. I mean, you know, to undergo any kind of misery and pain, it's got to be the sweet side to it, the ecstatic side to it. So this was an extremely intense, I would say, an extremely intense love period that had the components of ecstasy in it as well as the components of pain. And what I tried to do, this is the only time I've ever tried this in my life, actually, is as a poet kind of to document the entire experience as a poet, you know, rather than just like one poem. Sometimes you're involved with somebody and you just write a poem when you're happy or you just write a poem when you're breaking up. This is the whole thing, the whole deal.
It's extremely vulnerable. Do you feel exposed by it when you read it, for instance, in public, or have you read it in public?
Yeah, I've just begun reading some of them. I haven't yet read the whole series all the way through. I don't know. That would probably be difficult. In public, I would probably find it difficult. I seem to find a need to switch around so to make sure people are laughing and, you know, and so forth, so we can keep a balance, so I can keep a balance too, and keep people's minds on the poetry, you know, and not myself.
Well, what amazed me about it is that, you know, often poets, whether they present themselves as exemplary in any way or not, they're received as exemplary as people who've at least made progress to integrating their personal life with their public life, to choosing a kind of life that they would prefer to live, the life of a writer rather than as a worker, a life of self-expression and creativity. What made this such a powerful sequence for me is there's a certain level of abjection in it that says, yes, you know, as a poet, I may be expected to have solved some of these problems, but no, what I've done is achieved an ability to express them. The mm-hmm. giving voice to, mm-hmm. rather than the solution, seemed to be what was moving here.
Well, that's true. I mean, there are many huge differences for me, anyhow, between working in the world as a poet and working in the world as, say, an essayist or something. And the thing about being a poet for me is really it's about telling the truth. While I might like to come up with a solution, if we define the problem as the problem of rejection, I actually cannot do that. I mean, that's not true, right? Because that relationship is two people. And if if I love you and you don't love me, there's nothing I can really do about that except as a poet to express that, what that feels like, or how you said that to me or whatever, as best I possibly can.
Can I ask you to read one of them? I choose this one because it talks about both the pleasure and the pain and the itemizations of them. This is June Jordan reading poem for Haruko from Haruko.
I never thought I'd keep a record of my pain or happiness, like candles lighting the entire soft lace of the air around the full length of your hair, a shower organized by God in brown and auburn undulations, luminous like particles of flame. But now I do retrieve an afternoon of apricots and water interspersed with cigarettes and sand and rocks we walked across. How easily you held my hand beside the low tide of the world. Now I do relive an evening of retreat, a bridge I left behind where all the solid heat of lust and tender trembling lay as cruel and as kind as passion spins its infinite tergiversations in between the bitter and the sweet. Alone and longing for you, now I do.
June Jordan, reading poem for Haruko. Now, tell me, I heard the essays. There's a certain rhetorical eloquence to them, as well as certain refrains that run through them and repeat. They do seem to be made for the voice to be given, and some of them were commencement addresses. The poetry seemed very much more private, and I had to really listen to them in a different way. Do you distinguish between an essay voice and a poetry voice?
Oh yeah, because to me, an essay is a public political act or undertaking, let's say, and the idea is to try and persuade somebody to think about something in a new way, or to give, you know, my point of view, my way of my perspective, a shot anyhow. So it's an action related to persuasion. I mean, what I'm trying to do is persuade somebody else of something. If all I want him to do, or I hope he will do, it is just to wait a minute and listen, if not to me, to somebody else. Do you know? But with poetry, as I said, it's different. It's not about persuading anybody else of anything. I mean, as I live as a poet, it's about, this is what I really feel, and this is what I really, or what I really see, or in that sense, know, you know? And to present that as precisely as I possibly can.
Now the final poem, the poem before the final poem is a long Roman poem which seems to coalesce the earth, the volcano in Pompeii, physical passion, nuclear war. It's sort of a collage poem, and I found myself wondering if you could tell me how it came to be written.
Well, I was actually there at Pompeii. I had a prix de Rome in environmental design, so I was based in the Academy in Rome. And I went on an archaeological dig with archaeologists and architects, and everybody else had cameras and stuff, and I had my yellow pad and my ballpoint pen. And I just took... I asked a lot. I drove the guys crazy. I asked so many questions. What kind of a tree is that? You know, why is that rock there? You know, I was just driving them crazy, and they were great. So I actually was there in Pompeii. I mean, in Pastum and all those places there. I actually walked those places and stood among those places, those rocks and things, and It was incredible because it was an extremely sensuous experience. I mean, overwhelmingly sensual, you know. And of course, this whole thing's a graveyard, you know. So there was this fundamental schism there of experience that was really quite dizzying for me, and I couldn't get over it. I'd never seen like at Paestum, which is not far from Pompeii, the temple there. It's so worn from time and itself and the elements in the air and so on. I can't imagine anything more gorgeous, sensually speaking, and stuff. And of course, it's totally deserted. It serves no human purpose and so on. And actually, people had to leave because the whole area became poison. The water became poisonous to human life and all this kind of stuff. When I returned to Rome, I just went to my study, which was a little desk, basically, and I just stayed there for like 3-4 days. I didn't do anything else but write this thing, Roman Poem of. I had to get it out of my system because it was frightening to me.
Well, it seemed very, you know, central to your work because it seemed that as an environment, it's poised between sensuality and death. Yeah. This seems, you know, almost as if this is the natural battlefield. These are the artifacts. This is the present and the resurrection of the past. And it seemed as if very much, you know, a June Jordan environment where everything has to take place.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'm not sure, but I'm just thinking aloud. I think that's the first and only time that when I was making love with a man, at any rate, you know, that he was not able to have an erection. I mean, it's in the poem, as you know. But I think that's the only time that ever happened. That was during that trip. And it just seemed, you know, afterwards it just seemed absolutely consistent with the whole experience. I was like, you know, it's like, here we are, you know, like very excited about each other, and so what? Can't do nothing about it. Do you know what I mean? It was like that. But the beauty of the excitement of our interest in each other was there, nevertheless, just my excitement about these, you know, columns rising and into the sky, I didn't care about anything going on below it, was for real. I mean, it was for real, but this was not an environment hospitable to human life or sensitive to human life at all. I mean, whether we're talking Pompeii or Paestum, no. On the contrary, we're talking more inimical to human life, even in California.
I've been speaking to June Jordan, the author of two books that have recently been released. First, a book of essays, Technical Difficulties from Vintage, and a book of her poetry from High Risk, Serpent's Tail Books, Haruko, Love Poems. Thank you for joining us, June. I very much enjoyed
it. Thank you very much, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.